I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, instrument scientist Dr. Dennis Reuter of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center on the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Today's interview is the latest in a series for the Mind's Eye audio installation, which will soon be on tour, visiting Manchester, Bristol and Bradford over the coming months. Go to shrinkingspace.com for more information.
My name is Dennis Reuter. I'm a scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, which is in Greenbelt, Maryland. And on the Pluto mission, I'm the Ralph Instrument Project Scientist. And what that means is that the Ralph instrument, which is a combined multispectral imager, meaning it takes pictures at high spatial resolution in a few wavelength bands that are pretty close to visible wavelengths. They're sort of what you would see if you were staring at Pluto from 10,000 kilometers away, which will be more or less where we are when we're at closest approach. It also has an infrared spectral imager. And what that is an instrument that takes many spectral elements in the infrared, specifically between about 1.2 and 2.5 microns. And the way to think of that is that 1.2 microns is about a wavelength that's twice as long as you can see with your eye. 2.5 is four times as much as long as you can see with your eye. And we take a lot of spectral elements between those two wavelengths because they tell us a lot about the composition of the surface. So the two parts of Ralph, MBIC, which is the visible near-infrared imager, and LISA, which is the infrared spectral imager, are very complementary. The infrared spectra is not taken at quite as high resolution, spatial resolution. We don't see things quite as clearly with the infrared as we do with the visible. And the two spectral ranges tell us a lot about the surface, a lot about the composition. It tells us a lot about the structure. It tells us a lot about the variation of these things as we go along. So that's a basic summary of what Ralph does.
So how did you originally become interested in planetary science before it became a career?
I'm from the age when we were just starting to really get into in situ space exploration. In other words, people and satellites being able to go into space. And it just fascinated me when I was growing up, the possibilities that one could learn a lot about all the planets and other objects that are in our solar system by sending something out there and visiting them. And as that became more and more prevalent, we'd find out that what we had thought we knew from the ground observations was often wrong. And what we found out when we had spacecraft that went by the systems was just fascinating. I mean, there are lots of volcanoes on Io that are spitting out stuff. Who would have thought of that? Io being a moon of Jupiter. There are just so many interesting things going on that we've learned from the space exploration, but the robotic space exploration, that it's hard to imagine not being fascinated by it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So it's just been always something that I've found very, very fascinating. And the relationship between what we learn on other objects and Earth, Earth being a planet in a solar system, when we look at other planets and objects in the solar system, it tells us something more about how Earth came about and you know, what our history is here. It connects all to what we do in everyday life.
So what else have you worked on before New Horizons?
Before New Horizons, I've worked on a number of opportunities for investigation. And I'll get to, there's a bit of a history here. I was more of a laboratory scientist, theoretical scientist, taking spectra of molecules that we see on the Earth and also in space, and started getting very fascinated by the equipment that does that. Now, what you have in labs is not very applicable to what you need on a spacecraft, because in a lab you can play with things, and in a spacecraft you really can't. And a lab, you don't really care if something weighs a whole lot of, you know, if it weighs a whole lot, if it gets you the data you want, but you can't do that on a spacecraft. So there's an interesting combination of the two to get into that. So the opportunity for proposing a type of instrument, a spectral instrument for Pluto came along. One of my collaborators, Don Jennings, and I came up with a concept for a very light, very robust spectrometer, which is what is now flying on New Horizons. But this was well before the mission was approved. And that technology has actually flown on Earth missions. We've used it to take spectra of the Earth to take out the effect of the atmosphere on measurements of the surface. It is going to be flying on another space mission to an asteroid, Bennu, as part of the OSIRIS-REx mission. And it led me to do things on other platforms. For example, on the most recent Landsat satellite, the Landsat 8 that was launched in 2013, there's a thermal infrared sensor called TIRS on Landsat 8 that I'm the instrument scientist for. So the technology development that we did for Pluto fed into things that we did for Earth, which fed into things that we did for other space missions, and then gave us more confidence in what we were going to do for Pluto, and so has just kept evolving that way. So I've been involved in 5 space missions so far. Well, one will be launched in September of 2016. So 4 have launched and 1 coming up, the one for the asteroid.
Before we talk specifically about New Horizons, it's part of, I guess, an umbrella of projects called New Frontiers, New Frontiers programs. So what's that? What does that mean?
The New Frontiers programs are programs that NASA has initiated for specific missions to do specific things that are proposed by a principal investigator. So the principal investigator is the one responsible for the whole mission. Their biggest missions that NASA does that are in that principal investigator mode. So far there have been 3 chosen: New Horizons, going to Pluto, Juno, which is at Jupiter, and the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is going to Bennu to return a sample. They're focused in the sense that there's a specific target that one is looking at or a specific action that one is doing. And they're kind of at the $1 billion cost limit. That includes launching and making the spacecraft and making all the instruments and so on and so forth. So it's a combined science effort of trying to define what is the interesting science at an object or at in an area, and then what is the optimal set of instruments that go into that, help you define that mission, help you get the data you need to answer the questions that you've asked in defining the mission.
New Horizons, what is it? What are the goals?
The New Horizons mission's goals are to explore an area of space that we haven't looked at close up before. This is the area called the Kuiper Belt objects. They're leftovers from the early solar system formation. And because they're very far out, Pluto is 34 times further from the sun than the Earth is. And it gets much further out because it has what's called a very elliptical orbit. It's not a circle. It's sort of an ellipse. And We're going out to the furthest, well beyond 33 AU. We're looking at a new type of bodies that haven't been observed up close before. And so its goal is to understand what is the composition on those bodies. How does the composition vary as a function of position on that body, which tells us something about how things move around on very cold objects. Remember, Pluto is kind of on the order of minus 240 centigrade, so sort of 40 Kelvin, 30, 40 Kelvin is what the surface temperature is. There is some atmospheric gas that's a little warmer, stuff coming off the surface, but it's so cold out there that you freeze nitrogen onto the surface. Nitrogen exists in Pluto as a solid. So we're trying to understand what the composition is, what the history of impact history, what happened during the development of these bodies that are very representative of what made the Earth, what made the other planets, but has not been affected by all the processes that go on in the inner solar system, by so much radiation coming from the sun, by gravitational effects in the inner solar system. They were affected a long time ago by gravitational effects that threw them out there. So we kind of look at this as kind of a time machine. We're being able to go back and look at the history of the solar system 4 billion years ago by looking at these objects now. They maintain that history. They don't have the erosion that you see on Earth and in the other inner solar system objects. So that's sort of the goal, is to understand the development of our solar system and how the planets came about and perhaps how the building blocks for life and other things got to the inner solar system.
Irving Finkel, and you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Now, as you mentioned, this is the first time we're going to Pluto, and we'll talk about that more in a moment, but it's not the first mooted mission to Pluto. There was a mission, the Pluto Fast Flyby and the Pluto Kuiper Express, both of which were cancelled. So tell us something about how this process works. Why did this mission get off the ground and those ones didn't?
I think the reason the New Horizons mission got off the ground versus some of the earlier missions was that, as you can imagine, there is a fair amount of scientific competition for the resources to do these missions. The Pluto Fast Flyby, the Pluto Kuiper Express, those were actually perhaps in some cases the amount of money that was requested, they were more complex missions in some cases. In fact, some were originally two flyby opportunities. And so there's just a lot of competition for resources. And I think that as more was understood about the solar system, remember when Pluto missions were first being proposed, Pluto was considered to be sort of the furthest out object that we really could see as part of the solar system. There were other areas proposed. There was the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, but nobody had observed them. Nobody had seen what was going on there. As time went on and we started to understand that, oh goodness, the Kuiper belt really is a very active and important part of the solar system for the reasons I was giving, for because of the number of bodies that are there, because they have the history of the solar system embedded in them. I think it became more and more recognized that the science drivers for going to Pluto, and remember, when we go to Pluto, we are now also visiting not only Pluto, but its moon Charon, or Charon, depending on how you want to pronounce that, and then four other newly discovered moons that have been discovered actually since New Horizons was initiated. So there was just a growing science driver for doing this, and the time became right. There was a good match between, again, the This is a mission that is very far out, so you can't really use solar power. You need very, very small and yet capable instruments. A lot of technologies came together to make it possible. So the combination of the science becoming very compelling, or perhaps more compelling than it was originally, and the capability of doing the mission with technology that we could use at the time, I think just made it gave it a very strong push.
So I guess when we go somewhere that we've been before, if we're going a mission to Saturn or to Mercury, places that are difficult to get to but we've been before, we learn things from each of those missions in terms of the nuts and bolts of getting there. What are the unique challenges of going somewhere that we've never been before?
The challenges of going to Pluto are severalfold. Because we've never been there before, we have to use a bit more of our instinct, if you will, to understand what would be the ideal measurements to make. And I think we've come up with a very nice mixture of instruments, a mixture of imaging and radio and particle instruments that are flying on New Horizons that tell us a lot about the not only what the bodies are, how they look, but also what particles are coming off from them and what their thermal properties are like and so on. The other challenge is that because you've never been there before, there is a fair amount of uncertainty in, are there hazards that you have to worry about? Are there more particles that if you have a very fast spacecraft going through, will you hit them? And that's something that we've considered very strongly on New Horizons. Also, if you think about it, all the things, because we're so far away from the planet, we're so far away from Earth, when we're doing our observations on Pluto, we have to have everything very well planned. We can't send a command saying, okay, you're here now, start to do something, because it would take 4 hours for that command to get from the Earth to the spacecraft, and then it would take 4 hours for the spacecraft to come back and say, yes, I did that. So we basically would have flown by Pluto in the time that it takes just the command to go back and forth. So everything had to be very well choreographed. That is a challenge also, because we've launched a spacecraft that, as after you launch something, you learn much more about the details of how it actually operates. And so that has to be taken into account in the planning. And when there's competition between the various instruments, and I don't mean competition in a bad sense, I meant that there are a lot of measurements that one wants to do, and there are optimal times for doing each of those. And so planning a very comprehensive and very high science return encounter is a very detailed process. And it's gone on from before launch and is still going on now. We're still testing the operations that are being done to make sure that they do what we expect them to do at the very detailed level. So those are all part of the challenges of getting out there.
Listed to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to Dr. Dennis Reuter, and we're talking about the New Horizons mission to Pluto. And Dennis, I want to talk about the scientific equipment that's being carried by New Horizons. But before we do that, it's carrying some other artifacts, including, I understand, some of Clyde Tombaugh's ashes.
Yes, it is. That was a decision made by the principal investigator, Alan Stern, and others, was that when we launched, Pluto was the last planet that had been discovered, and we thought that, and Alan thought that it was a very fitting tribute to Clyde Tombaugh, who was the discoverer of Pluto, that we include his ashes on a mission that was flying by the planet that he discovered.
I think that's such a wonderful idea. I really do.
I think so too.
Let's talk about the scientific equipment that's being carried by New Horizons then. So you talked briefly at the beginning about RALF, which is the project that's obviously closest to your heart. All of these instruments have got wonderful names. We could talk about why it's called RALF, but there's Alice, there's Lorry, there's Pepsi, there's Rex. Tell us about some of these other instruments and what they're for.
The Lorry instrument is a, if you recall, I mentioned that RALF takes pictures in the visible and sort of near infrared in several wavelength bands. And it does it at a higher resolution than LISA does its infrared studies. Well, LORI, which is an instrument from APL, does what's called a panchromatic image. It's covering basically all the wavelengths from blue, the shortest wavelength that you can see, up to wavelengths a bit longer than you can see, from 0.4 microns, which is blue, to about 0.95 microns. And you can see stuff up to about 0.7 microns. So it's covering our visible region and a little bit beyond. But they're at higher spatial resolution. They're four times higher spatial resolution than the MVIC channels are. And then, of course, the MVIC channels are three times higher spatial resolution than the LISA channels are. So LORI provides these very nice high-resolution measures of geography and shadows that tell us about altitudes and also texture and so on. So, again, a very complementary, those two instruments are very complementary to each other. LORI also helps us find Pluto and guide ourselves to Pluto. It does what's called optical navigation. We look at Pluto with regard to what's going on with the stars around it, and it helps us choose exactly where to go during the planning. Then there is Alice, and Alice and RALF were originally combined as one instrument called Percy, but we decided it was more effective to slip them off because Alice is a ultraviolet spectrometer, whereas LISA is looking in the infrared, spectral elements in the infrared. Alice is looking at spectral elements in the ultraviolet, which tells us a lot about the atmosphere of Pluto. And when I say atmosphere of Pluto, it's not like the atmosphere on Earth where you could breathe it or even notice it. It's a very, it's a million times less pressure, more than a million times less pressure than the atmosphere on the Earth. So it's a very wispy, very small atmosphere, but ALICE is a very sensitive instrument that will tell us what's there. And again, there's that complementary nature between the various instruments, a different wavelength band that we're looking at in RALF, but tells us when we look at them with all three instruments, we'll learn a lot about what's going on. Now, Alice and RALF were named for a situation comedy that was on American TV literally back in the late 50s called The Honeymooners. And there was an Alice Cramden and a RALF Cramden were two of the characters on it. So that's where the names came from. Then we have the SWAP and Pepsi instruments, and they're looking at ions that are generated from the tenuous atmosphere of Pluto and its interaction with the particles that are flowing from the sun, so from the solar wind, if you will, which has also got a lot of ions on it. And that, again, tells us a lot about the interaction of Pluto with the solar environment and the environment out there. And then there's finally Rex, which is it's a very high resolution radio instrument that can tell us exactly where the spacecraft is with respect to Earth, how far away it is, by measuring very small changes in the wavelength that it's sending back, Doppler shifts and so on. It also measures, because it's a thermal instrument, because it's a radio instrument, it can measure very low temperatures. So we can sort of look at the emission from Pluto at these very long wavelengths that are given off by a very cold object. So that's the instrument complement, and it's a very, very complementary complement of instruments on the New Horizons mission.
I want to talk about the journey to Pluto then. So it's been a long journey already. Looking at the regularly updated countdown on Wikipedia, the launch date was 9 years, 2 months, and 1 day ago as we record this. There was a delay in the launch. The launch was supposed to be in September of 2005, and it ended up launching on the 19th of January 2006. So Why did that happen, and what were the implications of that?
It originally, there were some issues that had to do with, remember that Pluto is so far away from the sun that we can't use a solar source, we can't use a solar generator to generate the electricity. And so we are using a what's called a radioisotopic thermal generator. So it's a radioactive material that decays and generates heat that we convert into electricity. And part of the problem was that it was a little difficult to get some of that radioactive material. So that pushed things out a little bit. There are always some, you know, technical issues that go on. The impact really was, again, in the planning. There were, if you would have launched in 2015, the encounter would have been at slightly different, you know, geometries and so on and so forth. So that was accounted for. And I don't think that really we had, once we could do the planning well enough, and by we, I mean there's a very large team that was involved in getting New Horizons to its launch, we accounted for it. And so the shift from September to January really didn't have too big of an effect on the return, the scientific return.
An interesting fact about the launch is that it's described as the fastest spacecraft ever launched. So why was that?
Because we're going far out into the solar system and we wanted it not to take forever. So the launch vehicle was a very large rocket. And if you looked at the spacecraft itself, it's, you know, sort of like the size of a grand piano or something like that. And it was made that way because we wanted to be able to get to Pluto as fast as we could. There are some things that are changing. As Pluto goes further out in its orbit, it gets colder and some of the gases in its atmosphere start to get more condensed. So you get less atmospheric coverage. So there is some drive to make sure that we got out there before Pluto got too far away from the sun so that we'd still have a good atmosphere to look at. I think the way to look at the speed of New Horizons was it took, I believe it was 9 hours to get from the Earth to the Moon, you know, compared to if you look at how long it took the Apollo astronauts to get there, it was several days. And we made it to Jupiter after only 14 months, so much faster than most missions going out there. And then we used Jupiter for a gravity assist that helped us get to Pluto. So it really was to make sure that we got to Pluto in good time.
Gaia Vince, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Along the way, and you just mentioned going via Jupiter, and when you're at Jupiter, there was science done. You got to test Ralph, for instance. You got to test the cameras and take photographs. There was also a unexpected flyby of an asteroid. So let's talk about those two aspects of the journey.
They were very interesting aspects. The flyby of the asteroid was verified as being at something we could get close enough to take.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Instruments. I think only a few months before we actually had to make the observations. So the planning there, now obviously we weren't going through a whole detailed set of observations because it's a small asteroid, we were fairly far away, and we didn't have a lot of time, but we wanted to test as soon as we could the operations. The way, for example, that Ralph takes images, it's not like a camera where you sit and point and take a frame down. You have to scan the field of view across the body, and you build up the picture by just sort of taking rows of data and making that into a big picture. So making sure that we understood how the spacecraft and the instrument reacted to each other was something we wanted to practice as soon as possible. And then given the fact that it was an interesting object, there was some scientific return, it was just perfect that we found that. So that was not in the original plan. The Jupiter observations always were in the plan. Again, Jupiter we used to do a gravity assist. And there we had more time to make a more detailed set of observations that were going to be, in outline at least, similar to what we're going to do at Pluto. Now, the instruments were made to operate much further away from the Sun than Jupiter was. So in some cases, for example, in Ralph's case, we couldn't take color pictures or panchromatic images of the whole of Jupiter because there was just too much light coming off and we couldn't make the rows go fast enough. But we could do images in a band that's primarily sensitive to absorption from methane, and the LISA spectrometer could take images also, as could LORI. So this was a very nice combination of, hey, we're being able to practice a lot of what we're going to do at Pluto with, hey, we also get some very nice science return from this. So it was very exciting, and it took a lot of effort, again, on the team who are running this thing, which is, you know, Southwest Research Institute is the PI group, and Applied Physics Laboratory are the ones who have the operationals control, the ones who control the spacecraft. And, of course, the science team was also feeding in requests for type of data to be taken. So it was that very nice collaboration amongst all the partners that made a very successful Jupiter encounter where we actually saw things that hadn't been seen before. We saw waves along the entire sort of circumference, or at least the quarter of the circumference of Jupiter we could see, waves that had been seen in little bits, but we saw that they went around the entire equator. That had never been seen. We could measure the velocity of those waves, and that tells us about the atmosphere of, you know, dynamics of Jupiter. So we could see ammonia coming up from storms into the upper atmosphere of Jupiter and watch it decay, or watch its spectral characteristics decay as it conglomerated with other materials that are up there. We could see volcanoes erupting on Io, and we could look at at the dust coming up from them. There was just a lot of things we were able to do and at the same time practice what we're going to do at Pluto. So it was a very exciting time.
And once we'd got beyond Jupiter, New Horizons started taking photographs of Pluto. What was the purpose of starting that so early?
The purpose of starting that, again, is that, well, that's where we're going, and we really wanted to see, there's a certain amount of, that's our goal, you know, when you first can start to see it, it's a milestone. But also, every year, the spacecraft, again, to save money, because here's something that's taking 9 years to get out to its prime target, if you had to have a full complement of people planning things and running the spacecraft, you know, as will happen in Pluto, it's very expensive. So we, meaning, again, the management and project office, had determined that it would be good to put the spacecraft into hibernation, where just sort of we monitored its health, its heartbeat, so to speak, but didn't really do anything. And then about 2 months a year, we would take it out of hibernation and make sure all the instruments worked and make sure that again, the spacecraft was interacting with the instruments and the commands as we expected. And so, you know, that process went on all the time. Well, now we took some images of Uranus and Neptune, and we want, you know, since we're doing this, it might as well be taking some images of Pluto. It took a while before we had enough sensitivity, but Lori got some images, and I've forgotten exactly when it was that they got their first images, when we were way far away from Pluto, and things are just getting better since then.
Roughly speaking, obviously, as we speak now, where is New Horizons?
It's closer to Pluto than the Earth is to the Sun, and I've forgotten exactly how far away it is from Pluto. We are now at the point where Lori is taking images that are better than the best images that were taken of Pluto before New Horizons were those taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And we've gotten to the point now where Lori is getting better resolution than those images, and that's just going to keep on getting better as we get closer. We'll get to Pluto, the closest we'll get to Pluto will be on July 14th, 2015. That's when we'll get to within roughly 10 to 12,000 kilometers of the surface of Pluto. And of course, leading up to that, there is already started a series of observations that are getting progressively better in all the instruments. And the reason we're doing that is that when we go by, Pluto has a 6-day rotation period. So just like, you know, the Earth rotates in a day, it takes roughly 6 Earth days for the Pluto to rotate. So the face that we're seeing at closest approach, you know, we only see that one side at closest approach. We don't get the really high resolution images of the other side. Which, you know, because we're 3 days out from that, when that side is facing the spacecraft. So we're taking data to look at what's called the light curve. How does the light vary through the various phases of Pluto? And that's going to happen up until the final impact. And that's going to be a very exciting day, but we won't get a whole lot of data back on that day because it takes a long time for the data to come back from Pluto itself. So a lot of our data from that new horizon, from most of the data we get from the closest approach, will actually flow down over the few months after the closest approach encounter date.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Dr. Dennis Reuter. We're talking about Pluto and the New Horizons mission. And so, Dennis, let's talk about that day in July when New Horizons arrives. Now, it's a flyby mission. It's not going into orbit, so there's a limited period of time to gather data. So What's going to happen when it arrives?
When Pluto arrives, or excuse me, when New Horizons arrives at Pluto, there's going to be the poor spacecraft is going to be very busy because it's going to be pointing not only at Pluto, it's going to be pointing at Charon, it's going to be pointing at Nix, Hydra, the other two moons, all the objects that are around there. This has all been planned over the last 9 years or so, and will successively take data in each of the spacecraft. For example, Ralph will get it will map the entire surface of Pluto in its panchromatic and four colors at a spatial resolution of better than a kilometer. LISA will get the spectra of the whole surface of Pluto at better than 10 kilometers. Those are places where we cover the entire surface. We'll get higher resolution as we get closer in, but it won't cover the entire surface. Similarly, LORI will be taking images of these objects at, four times higher spatial resolution than MVIC can. But a lot of the objects, we can't run LISA and MVIC at the same time, so we have to do the measurements. We take some LISA data, then we take some MVIC data, and then there are also combinations of instruments instruments that can't be done at the same time. And LORI and ALICE can't be taking data at the same time, or Ralph and ALICE can't be taking data at the same time. So those instruments, those combinations, they'll be taking data. We'll have a special time for them to take data that'll be different than the time that Ralph is taking data, that'll be different than the time that LORI is taking data. So that whole planning has been quite extensive, and at the end of the day, we're going to have just amazing spectral spatial coverage of all the objects that we're going by.
I mean, I guess I'm going to have to ask you to speculate a little bit because we haven't been there before, but what are we expecting Pluto to look like?
We have information on Pluto sort of at the, you put 2 pixels across it or 3 pixels across the surface from Earth-based observations. And so we know that there are certain molecules that are there. We know that there's methane. We know that there's water on Charon. We know that there's nitrogen ice on Pluto and so on. So we also know that as Pluto rotates, and if you look at the various even low resolution images, it looks like there's some structure. Now again, we can't, from what we've seen so far, we can't say, oh, look, there are valleys or craters or whatever. But we expect those to be there, and we expect them to have various sizes, and we expect to learn a lot about the dynamics that are going on in the object, in the system there, by looking at the various sizes of the objects. And when we look at the spectra and images, we can kind of tell, oh, are there cracks around them that might tell us something about what's going on? Is there water underneath the surface? If we see sort of cracks around the craters, that might indicate that. We'll also be looking for, what's the composition that's going on around those craters? So what I think we're going to see is the molecules that we've seen so far, perhaps some new ones, because there may be, when you're looking at the full surface, if there's only a little area that has a particular molecule, you won't necessarily see it. But when you can look at that particular part of the surface, you will see it. So I'm expecting that we'll see the molecules that we've seen, perhaps some others, that will be able to start to correlate where we see various molecules and where we see various structures with the dynamics of Pluto and its moons. And we'll perhaps be able to see has material moved from where it's illuminated by the sun, so it's a little warmer, to areas that are colder, sort of like the same thing that happens on Earth. So I think we're going to see a very nice variety of signatures, both chemical and optical. And also we'll see from the particle measurement instruments, we'll see, are there any unexpected outgassings going on? Do we see more stuff in the atmosphere coming off than we expected? Similarly with the UV, same sort of thing. Is the atmosphere looking like you can correlate to what's going on the surface? And from REXUS, we'll be able to say, is the temperature of the surface consistent with what we're seeing on, you know, from the composition and structure measurements that we're making? So there's a lot of things like that that we're going to get, and I'm hoping we also see things that surprise the heck out of us, and I just don't know what those would be.
So what about the moons? You've already mentioned that we've discovered some new ones on the journey.
We have been able to include observations of all those moons so that we get, at least 10 to 20 pixels across, perhaps with LORI and somewhat less with the other instruments, because again, obviously, the major focus was on Pluto, and a lot of the planning was done before we had seen the other moons, and obviously we're not going to change things all around to see them, but we have made some modifications to enhance the information we're going to get back from the moon, and again, we're expecting to see on them things like, what is the composition? Is it the same as what we're seeing on the other bodies? Pluto and Charon, which are right next to each other, really do have a different composition because Pluto is massive enough that it can store some molecules that the gravity can keep molecules on its surface that Charon can't. So Charon has a lot of water on it because water just doesn't evaporate at those, temperatures. Whereas Pluto has nitrogen and methane and other things on it. So what will we see on those other objects? Will we see other molecules? Will we see something that's been there sort of since it was formed? It's, again, gives us much more information about that whole, not only the Pluto system, but what's going on in the whole of the Kuiper Belt.
You mentioned there that Pluto has, a lot of nitrogen. Charon has a lot of water. I guess I want to talk about what the relationship is between Pluto and these objects. Because one thing I haven't bothered mentioning so far is this whole, is Pluto a planet or not a planet debate that happened. And is it still sort of valid to see Pluto as a planet with moons orbiting it? Or are these all like members of the same system, if you see what I mean?
I kind of avoid talking about that because
I thought you might.
because to me, Pluto in some ways doesn't care what it's called. We know that they're representative of this class of objects that we haven't visited before. And so, it's a nomenclature thing that at the end of the day, when we see what we find on Pluto, we're going to say, this is really amazing. This is really interesting. It tells us a lot about us, and in some sense, do we care what it's called?
But interestingly, though, if you say, obviously we're anthropomorphizing it, but if Pluto doesn't care what it's called, Charon might, because the corollary of saying is Pluto is downgrading Pluto might be upgrading Charon to an object of the same thing.
Yeah, and in a way, Pluto and Charon are kind of more related. I mean, they're sort of orbiting a point that's, the center of the gravity of the whole system, which is more displaced from Pluto than it is from, the Earth or Jupiter or Mars, because they're larger objects and the things that are orbiting them are smaller relative to each other. But again, I think after we get our observations, people are going to just be excited about the fact that we've gotten these new measurements of these new bodies, and I kind of will leave it up to everybody else to worry about what you call it, because we all are going to be very excited about what we found out.
We'll be right back. I'm Ben Goldacre. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Subsequently then, after New Horizons has studied Pluto and the Moon, there's a possibility of it being able to observe Kuiper Belt objects. So, well, let's talk about what they are first, and then let's talk about what might happen.
Sure. The Kuiper Belt objects are objects that are left over from an area on the, in the solar system where smaller objects were made, but they never got fully conglomerated into one object that doesn't have anything else around it, like is what you see in the inner solar system. Now, you know, whether that means that they're not planets or not, that's to me nomenclature. But because they're these leftovers from that early formation process, and they just haven't been too disturbed, you know, we're kind of looking at a chemistry set of what made up the early solar system. And so for us to compare the objects around Pluto and the objects around Pluto, Charon and the moons of Pluto, and I'll call the moons of Pluto just because I think it's easier, with an object that is at a different area away, again, tells us perhaps more about the dynamics that were going on during formation, and it may tell us a little bit more about, or a lot more, about what processes have occurred since their formation. So there have been objects identified that we can almost certainly get to with the fuel on board that we have and so on, but they're not part of the mission yet. We've identified the objects, and I'm sure that a proposal will be made to extend the mission beyond, but officially it's not there yet, but we know that there are things that we can get to, and we'll see how it pans out after we have the Pluto encounter. But it would be very nice to be able to get more statistics, if you will, to see something, another object in this general area that is not from Pluto itself, and from the Pluto system itself.
And what else is there beyond the primary objectives of the mission that could be done given the time and the location and everything? What else would you like to see happen science-wise if we're able to?
Well, of course, the imagers, unless you're close to an object, then and you really don't get much from the imagers, unless it's a very large object. And as of course, as we get further from the sun, the amount of light that we have to be reflected from the objects is getting less. So beyond this, sort of a relatively close object that we can get to, I think the imagers will not provide too much data. But again, there are these other instruments on there. There is the radio instrument that can still tell us how Pluto is behaving, how New Horizons is behaving as it keeps on going out through the solar system. I mean, it's just going to keep going until it gets to the end. It never will stop. The particle instruments, SWAP and PEPSI, will of course be able to tell us about the composition out there and how the interaction of the solar wind is with whatever other material is out there, and there's another instrument that I apologize for not mentioning before, because it was not sort of one of the complement of original instruments. It's the student dust counter, which is an instrument that was made by students at University of Colorado that looks at impacts of dust onto it and, counts how many dust particles are out there. Well, that's the information that we could get for a long distance out. So I think that there are things that we could still monitor as time goes on. Obviously, the power supply, which is, again, I mentioned this radioactive power supply, it has a lifetime. It starts to not being able to power, the instruments and transmit data back at any reasonable rate after a while. It still is going to be active for quite a while. So I'm hoping that there will always be, always be a recognition that there may still be some data to come out way beyond where even the extended mission, if we, propose to go to this other object, is, and that we can get some information back as far as we can get information.
And then what happens? What's the ultimate fate of New Horizons?
It just keeps going. It just keeps going, and it leaves our solar system. Now, you know, it's the fastest thing that ever left Earth, but it's still slow compared to the speed of light, right? So it just keeps going and keeps traveling, and, you know, eventually we'll get to a star, but that will be a long, 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 long time from now. And I kind of really like that from a personal standpoint. It's just this thing that keeps going, and you know, like the Voyager and Pioneer spacecraft that have also gone out and in some cases even left what we call the solar system, you know, defined by where the wind from the sun sort of is more important than just sort of the general stellar galactic background. So it just keeps going.
And that's an instrument that you've worked on that will certainly outlive you. It'll outlive all of us. It'll probably outlive the planet.
Yeah, I'm always reminded of, when I think about it, you know, the Ozymandias thing, look upon my works, you mighty in despair. You know, when we're talking about, say, pyramids on Earth, well, this thing is just going to be, exactly, it just keeps going. And you know, unless something dramatic happens, it just keeps going. And yeah, it's just fascinating. Now, of course, something will happen there. I'm sure that, you know, eventually, I don't know, I'm not sure if it will just keep lasting forever. I don't know of any really strong things that would mess it up. You know, there's some vapor pressure, there's some friction from the occasional dust particle or gas, but it's really small. So yeah, it just seems like it would last forever.
There's lots of reasons why we're going to Pluto science-wise, but another reason is because we haven't been there before, and that for me is reason enough. But beyond that, why Pluto? Does Pluto give us, the studying Pluto give us insight into elsewhere in the solar system?
Yes. Again, it's that time machine thing. It's going back and saying, okay, this is what the solar system looked like 4.5 billion years ago. How did that become what we see on the inner solar system now? And what does it tell us about, you know, again, there's the Oort cloud. The Kuiper belt is sort of a collection of objects that are kind of in the same plane as the planets, you know, as they go around the sun. The Oort cloud is this spherical cloud that's even further out, and occasionally stuff gets perturbed by stars as it comes out of the Oort cloud, and we see it as it comes in. So it tells us perhaps more about what's going on beyond Pluto, as well as telling us what went on inside of Pluto. So it's that being able to go out to these pristine things and see what's going out there and then extrapolate that to other areas of the solar system that makes the visit so exciting.
Dennis Reuter, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about Pluto and New Horizons.
And thank you very much for your interest. I think that it's an exciting mission, and I just can't wait to get the data down and report to everybody, this is what we saw.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.